Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. And I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm doing great, David.
Happy 4th of July week.
Okay, yes. It's the 3rd of July.
What's the 3rd of July? People will be listening to this as they prepare their barbecue or whatever it is they're doing for the 4th of July. Who knows what they're doing?
I think you wildly exaggerate what our listeners do.
I have no idea. I don't surmise what our listeners do and don't do while they're listening to our podcast. They may be doing it. Who knows? All people in the future. Hello, people in the future. We have with us a special guest, Teresa Valdi, who has been on the show before to talk about Star Wars, but today we're not talking about Star Wars. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
She's a friend of the pod.
Friend of the pod. Here we're on the our usual death row corridor. Here in the old medical building. Right. So the topic for this week, we want to look at the controversy over immigrant detention on the U.S. border, and actually in many ways across the United States, and what the proper terminology is to describe these centers in which immigrants are being held. Frank, do you want to sort of provide some context for this so we can sort of dive in?
Sure. So on, I think it was June 17th, so it was a couple of weeks ago, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York, tweeted about the detention centers along the Texas-Mexico border and used the described them as concentration camps. And I think in a subsequent tweet, she also used the phrase, which was resonant from the Holocaust, never again. And so the use of this language has set off a kind of debate that's still raging, in fact, about whether this is an appropriate term or not. It's one of the reasons we have Teresa here, because she has expertise in the history of the Holocaust. The debate's moved on a little bit. The U.S. Holocaust Museum last week issued a statement condemning the use of this language, but in this week's issue of the New York Review of Books, there's a letter signed by a large number of specialists in European history and the history of the Holocaust and genocide, responding to the Holocaust Museum's assertion that this was Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, her use of language was inappropriate. These historians have said no, it was entirely appropriate. And so we've had a debate over 2 weeks about the use of language, and particularly this phrase, concentration camps. And it's become even more, I guess, relevant because over the past few days, several members of Congress have gone down to the border to visit some of these sites and to have a look and to find out what conditions the asylum seekers are being held in. So we have an ongoing debate about the use of internment by the U.S. government, and particularly this phrase, concentration camps.
And we have accounts of massive overcrowding in these facilities, facilities that are designed for a dozen people having 50 people staying in facilities that are designed for temporary detention, being used for weeks and if not months, people being denied showers and children being denied soap and toothbrushes.
And children being looked after by other children.
Children and all kinds of, and inadequate food and what have you.
And also specifically the deterioration of the health of children being held in these facilities. So the spread of lice, the punitive measures taken against children who are sharing combs, for example, or lose their combs. So we've had these reports come through, which is an indication of something quite severe in terms of the effect that this is going to have on these children in the long run, but also that it then becomes a bit more understandable why the term concentration camp has surfaced in this context.
So I guess the big question then is, as somebody who has studied the concentration camps from the Second World War in far greater detail than Frank and I have, to what extent is this term, does it work, does it not work, what does it capture, what does it miss?
And that is that is an incredibly difficult question, so thanks for putting me on the spot.
Sorry.
I thought we'd ease you in.
Yeah. Okay.
No. And actually, I've been thinking about this quite a bit over the last couple of weeks, particularly when the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, I think it was on the 24th or the 25th of June that they issued the response And the sort of detail, it was about a 3-paragraph-long response, and one of the lines was that the museum does not either condone or accept equivalencies and comparisons being drawn both historically and contemporarily, which I found to be a bit of a sort of strange twist as a historian particularly. And my initial reaction was, but that's not really what the museum itself does. So particularly its involvement with other foundations, other centers, and the message of Holocaust remembrance in the last few years has been, in conjunction with Never Again, has been to look at parallels, to understand patterns that are emerging in persecuting societies that escalate to genocidal activities. So that statement I found really problematic, but also not necessarily that indicative of what, you know, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum actually stands for as an online database of excellent sources to use as students and educators, but also in terms of its outreach and the scholars associated with the center. So again, that I feel that response was not necessarily the best thing to put out. However, was it an attempt to maybe distance from the politics of the statement? Mm. Could that, could we read it or interpret it in that way? What do you think?
Well, I mean, obviously the whole debate over whether these are concentration camps is deeply politicized at the moment, because for the most part, tends to be people on the left who are saying these are concentration camps, people on the right who are saying that they're not. So just like everything else in American politics, or everything else in American public life now, it's through the prism of politics. I'm struck by the use of the phrase "never again," which obviously has very deep resonances with Holocaust memory and the ways in which the survivors of the Holocaust and everyone else that subsequently have tried to think about it. It implies a kind of comparative model. Like if you say never again, that implies that we need to stop something from happening again by taking proactive measures, which implies that the Holocaust was not isolated in a historical vacuum, that it is a part and parcel of human history that could happen again in a different form, in a different way, and we should be on the lookout for it so it won't happen again. I think that's embedded within that phrase. And so it seems very odd to me that the Holocaust Museum would take this particular position. I know there's politics within the history of that museum that are probably at play here that's going on beneath the surface.
It seemed an incredibly strange statement to me as a non-specialist. I mean, I've been to the Holocaust Museum. It's an incredibly powerful place. It's a wonder. I mean, it's a fabulous example of public history, actually. But the whole point of public history is to inform the public,
yes,
and so that people can derive lessons. So we're all historians, so we understand we think we understand the purpose of history and the use of history, and the value of history. Public history institutions are involved in the same kind of mission that we are, and indeed often reach a far larger audience than we do. And so it seems slightly counterintuitive that the Holocaust Museum would issue such a statement, would kind of wade into a current political controversy and issue a statement which more or less can be read at one level as completely repudiating its purpose. But I think that has more to do with contemporary politics, I guess. But what I'm more interested in, I guess, I'm looking at Teresa now, is to say, well, as a historian of Europe in the middle of the 20th century, and particularly the Third Reich and the Holocaust, what was your response when you heard the use of the phrase concentration camps to describe these places in the United States?
So,
and as an American.
It always makes me think of the term concentration camps itself and why, the consensus of genocide studies and history of the topic, Holocaust history, is to identify that the way in which concentration camps is embedded in collective memory and has become a part of daily language is not nuanced enough and doesn't draw these differences between what were sites of extermination and what were sites that were meant to deter, detain, and concentrate individuals before being moved elsewhere. So there's that. There's the historian's brain that kicks in and says, well, the term itself is. I wish it's something we could move away from. Unfortunately, 50 years of 60, 70, we're not in 2000, 20 years later. So many decades of using the term and its impact and its embedded nature shows that it's difficult to dislodge. So we kind of do have to take concentration camp as the catch-all term. So is it worth even wading into some of the historical nuance and debate and discussion surrounding sites of extermination, sites of forced labor, slave labor camps, all of the different delineations that we make as historians of this topic. And perhaps the case is less so for a debate in the public sphere such as this one. Therefore, if we look at so then I try to think about it as a historian who has done some public sort of engagement activity and as someone who's interested in memory and the public sphere more broadly speaking, then I think concentration camps becomes a term that's about form and function, in which case the act of deterrence, so crossing the border, and the methods used, they fill this sort of this dual definition of form and function, and in that sense they do become, these facilities do become concentration camps. So for me it wasn't that controversial to hear it being uttered by a member of Congress, not necessarily, and especially when we look at, again, public engagement surrounding the prevention of genocide, and as you mentioned, rightly so, never again, but also equivalencies being drawn between, particularly making individuals, so the different themes in the last couple of years for remembrance have been things like homelessness and refugee status, and in an attempt to speak to contemporary situations and current politics as well. Therefore, the more that I take these kinds of things into account, the more I think the phrase concentration camps is appropriate. And I would disagree with some aspects of it, but not enough to reject the term entirely and to think that it's a comparison that shouldn't have been uttered and is completely erroneous, not at all.
There was a story in the New York Times, or a column in the New York Times, I should say, over the weekend, and I've got to confess, I can't remember the author's name, but she made the argument that the better analogy were the internment camps of Vichy, France. I don't know if you saw that. And to some extent, I thought, well, okay, I get that, but it's kind of missing the point. I mean, it is the challenge, Teresa, that when we say concentration camps, and there is a history of this, which I think we'll get to, including in the American context, people think of the death camps. They think of Auschwitz.
Absolutely.
And that's the image that's conjured, and I think that's why some people were so outraged by the use of this term. But I think, again, you know this better than we do, I think the kind of internment camps in Vichy, France are on a continuum with the death camps.
Absolutely.
And it's that continuum that's so not all concentration camps are death camps, although all death camps are concentration camps. Is that a fair way to...
I do agree with that, absolutely, yeah.
It's been a long time since I've studied the Holocaust and I've never done it in any massive detail. What's the current thinking on the relationship between concentration camps and death camps and how they evolve both chronologically and systematically?
Well, there are several sort of key scholars who focus specifically on understanding the evolution of the concentration camp system in like a German context and in different contexts, looking at sort of the colonial relationship as well. But the current thinking is that it's been very difficult for historians to dislodge concentration camps, even though, of course, because of the specificity of the topic, it would be preferable to not have concentration camp mean Auschwitz-Birkenau, or for people to think of Treblinka and Sobibor, although that is less the case than Auschwitz. So the thinking is, particularly from the perspective of memory studies, which is what I'm interested in, is that, you know, concentration camps is here as a phrase, and the images that it conjures up and the associations that are, you know, that are sort of summoned by the phrase are here to stay, and it absolutely has been as a term. So different disciplinary perspectives are sort of coming to different conclusions, but it is more or less what Frank has mentioned about this is part of a concerted effort to exterminate the quote-unquote undesirables from society in a certain time period, and particularly, obviously, in the context of the Holocaust, the Jews of Europe. So it is a long-term function of extermination.
Mm. So I mean, I guess one of the objections to the use of the term now that people are raising, and I'm curious what you think about this, is that, you know, the German program with respect to Jews and with and regard to communists and homosexuals and various other groups that were persecuted during the Holocaust, you know, there was an intention embedded within the whole, from the very beginning, to exterminate and remove these populations that sort of culminates in death camps. And they would say that any comparison, therefore, with this modern context is faulty, because they claim that, you know, Trump is not Hitler, etc.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
Well, I think that speaks to this sort of intentionalist, long-term intentionalist vision that the concentration camps within the Third Reich context, within Nazi Germany, were originally created with already the notion of extermination in mind.
Mm-hmm.
When my argument, and most historians by this stage, and this is after, you know, this really happened in the 90s and the early 2000s, with historians such as Christopher Browning and Jürgen Mathaus and others, and then genocide, the widening into genocide studies as well. So Donald Bloxham, our colleague. And the camps originally were forms of social control. They acted as methods of deterrence. And extermination was not necessarily an aim. I would say it actually wasn't an aim in, let's say, the earliest camp, Dachau, founded in March of 1933, was to deter political opposition. And also, it operated on this this sort of premise of preemptive custody, really to protect individuals from the population. And this was the line, and this wasn't obviously the case.
Mm-hmm.
But this then deterred collective action against the consolidation of the Nazi Party, effectively, or was one of the ways in which that happened. And even when we look at the spread of more organized, sort of systematic concentration camps in the later 1930s, before the start of the Second World War, deterrence of action, internment, the concentration of individuals who were considered to be life unworthy of life, and I'm using that in quotations. Those were the aims of these centers, rather than outright extermination. And therefore, if we take that historical context into account, concentration camp does become, it's still a phrase that can be used in relation to these detention facilities.
And so, in fact, that's in kind of consonant with previous practice. This wasn't a uniquely German practice.
Absolutely.
So the Spanish used concentration camps in Cuba during the insurrection there in the 1870s and 80s. The United States did in the Philippines. During the turn of the 20th century. The British did in South Africa during the Boer War. The United States, of course, did during the Second World War when it interned Japanese Americans. But the interning of populations that were had not committed crimes necessarily, but they were members of groups that were deemed dangerous or subversive in some way, was in keeping with a kind of tradition. So there was a tradition of concentration camps, if you will, that emerges, at least in the Western world, over the decades before the Second World War.
Absolutely.
And the German case in the beginning is of a piece with that, as is the description, as I said, in that column in the Times the other day about Vichy France. That was more in keeping with that tradition.
Mm.
People might have died in those concentration camps, and they did, but that wasn't their purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't their explicit purpose.
Right.
Anyway, I mean, one of the things that struck me when AOC made that tweet and people responded to it was the initial supposition people had was that she was calling the Trump administration Nazis. If you call these concentration camps, they're, you know, people immediately made that jump to the only concentration camps we can think of are the ones that were used in the Holocaust, when in fact you could think about that term in a much broader context.
It's not a huge leap, though, to make.
To be sure.
Given that, as Teresa's told us, and when you say concentration camps, it evokes Auschwitz in 1945, not what was going on in the Boer War for most people, including for AOC, I'm guessing.
Well, that's probably true, although she seems to have a very well-developed historical sense.
I agree, but when you say concentrate, in other words, we may want to go there. We may support her going there, but I don't think it's I don't think her critics are wrong when they say that's where she was going.
Okay.
And I mean, we do have to take into account that that is the impact that it has had. So several people have made that leap. Why have they made that leap? And you're right. It isn't the sort of historian's response is, well, that's a ridiculous, absurd argument to make. It's sort of, you know, arguing with absurdities, extending the argument, which you can do ad nauseum, right? But then, absolutely, because concentration camps means Auschwitz and a certain series of images, then that changes what the historian's response can and should be in this context. And again, I would always suggest more debate and discussion on the topic, but does that do anything for this never again preventative component that I think AOC was trying to then kind of stir up and generate?
What would have happened if she had, instead of saying concentration camps, said internment camps? What would the feedback have been? What would have been the political conversation if she had compared it to Japanese American internment?
I don't think there would have been the same backlash. In part because even the way people, and again, I'm looking to Teresa here as somebody who's an expert in the memory of all of this, historical memory. I don't think people, you know, in the American narrative, the Japanese internment is bad. And it's a kind of excess that we regret, and the government paid reparations for, etc. But in the grand scheme of what was going on in the world in 1942, it was a sort of understandable error. It was, I don't think internment, in answer to your question, David, I don't think it would have resonated in the same way because, I mean, that would have had a resonance, but I don't think it would have made the impact. AOC knows how to make an impact, and she's a very good political communicator. And I think she chooses her words. You know, she doesn't fire off tweets like the president does without thought. I think she knows what the power of language and her power, especially on social media. So I think she didn't use internment camps. She used concentration camps deliberately. In answer to your question, I think if she'd used internment camps, it wouldn't have had the same resonance. I don't know what you think, Teresa.
I agree. It also would have had a minimized response. And again, even though there have obviously been other, I guess maybe the discussion would have centered internment camps and sort of in other contexts, but it would, I think that the internment of Japanese American citizens would have probably been the focus of the discussion, which then wouldn't have, you know, the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum probably wouldn't have waded in, and it would have been a much more, or a less controversial statement to make.
Interestingly, George Takei, of course, the actor, but also somebody who was interned as a child during the war, tweeted about this, particularly with regard to the treatment of children in the camps. And he pointed out that when he was interned, he was treated better than the children. You know, children were generally interned with their
family.
Parents.
Yeah.
And they were also given some comforts, books and toys and
things,
toothbrushes. So he drew an unfavorable contrast. He wasn't saying, oh, internment was great, but quite the contrary, or during the war. But rather, by contrast, the conditions are even worse. And he could speak as a survivor and with some moral authority, and that was powerful as well. I'm asking you both now. What do you think the use of the term concentration camps to describe what's going on in these detention centers on the border and, as David said, elsewhere, is appropriate. It's literally appropriate, it seems to me, given the definition of concentration camp. But I think we're slightly passing the buck if we keep because, as you've told us, Teresa, that's not what people think when they hear that phrase.
So my reading of this is somebody who doesn't know as much about the Holocaust as he should necessarily, is that one of the things that does is it does spur people to action before it does become worse than it is, and it's already horrific. That, you know, the conditions there in these various camps, and obviously there are literally hundreds of these camps across the country at the moment, run by different government agencies and by private corporations now. You know, they are situations where you could have outbreaks of disease in them that would lead to deaths of hundreds of people, including the deaths of lots of children. The medical facilities don't seem adequate, and obviously...
And there already have been deaths.
Yes, but you know, the handful of deaths we've had thus far could really escalate very quickly. And you know, the only way to you need to create some kind of mass pressure to stop these camps from happening, or to improve the conditions of these camps, whatever you think the appropriate political remedy is. And given that everyone's outrage meter is already at 11, you gotta play the big cards to have an effect anymore. And the Holocaust is one of them.
I think it is appropriate. The more I sit and think about it, as both a historian and as a member of the public sphere and as a U.S. citizen, I think, and given what I do know about concentration camps, I think it is absolutely appropriate, especially if I think of one of the unifying themes and patterns of all sites of state-imposed suffering, that's structured to alter social norms, and this is always dehumanization. And, you know, this is happening at the moment in the border facilities, as we have seen, and that theme perhaps unites and maybe goes a bit sort of beyond some of the arguments against using the term concentration camps.
I guess one thing I'm worried about is that for people who are defending these camps, they could say, look, they're saying these are concentration camps, but they're no crematorium. This is not genocide. And therefore, your critiques are baseless because you clearly don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I think that's one line of defense people who are supporting the government's policy in holding people in these facilities is that if we play the Holocaust card, then that sort of we lose the argument as a consequence because they don't take it seriously.
Yeah, I mean, AOC was accused, among other things, this is obviously a gendered term, of being hysterical.
Yes.
And this react is an overreaction and so on. And therefore, you're overreacting because clearly these are not concentration camps in the death camp sense yet. and therefore, this overreaction means that none of it's true. And so you're right, there's a danger of backlash there. I mean, I'm interested. I mean, I agree with both of you. I think the term is appropriate, both historically and also because of its resonance, contemporary political resonance. However, I read something the other day about this that's really stayed with me, which is both her statement and, frankly, the response to it, which is to deny the outrage and pearl clutching that this anybody could possibly allege the United States would be involved in this, are both kind of premised on exceptionalist assumptions. So when AOC wrote that tweet or sent that tweet and then followed up, the implication was not never again, but never here. We shouldn't be doing, Americans shouldn't be doing this. And similarly,
Americans couldn't do it.
her critics basically have said exactly that Americans couldn't do it. And that flies in the face, of course, of American history. So Fort Sill, Oklahoma is one of the places that was identified as a destination. I'm not sure, I think they backed off it, but Fort Sill, of course, was a place where Native Americans were interned after the Civil War in the late 19th century, and Japanese Americans were interned during the Second World War. And so Americans have done this before, both in the kind of classic sense, but the history of the United States. So I would reject the exceptionalist premise of the outrage on both sides about this. Actually, one can argue we have a long history of this kind of behavior.
And we, you know, the geographic element of it, I think, is important, because they tend to put these camps in places where people can't see them, they can't visit them, they aren't subject to public scrutiny. Just like was the case with Japanese American internment, where they put them all in the middle, most of them were in the middle of deserts and other kind of remote locations. And same is true for, you know, what were effectively internment locations for Native Americans, right? And I think that's partially because that's vacant land and it's easy to use, but I think part of it is to, remove this kind of atrocity from places where it will be seen and criticized.
And also the potential for assistance undermining that sort of proximity of regular sort of passing by, meaning, and now I'm talking more in the context of the Second World War, but of giving food assistance or things like that, or smuggling people out, things in. So to extend what you were saying, Dave, the death camps, and I'm not saying concentration camps, the death camps in the Second World War, so Treblinka, Sobibor, Bjelovars, Chełmno, were all shrouded from public view, more or less. So in forests with high walls of barbed wire, they were generally inaccessible.
Yeah, I've been struck by the extent to which not only journalists haven't had access to these facilities, but members of Congress have had difficulty getting access to these facilities. Mm. I mean, that's just astounding that a member of Congress can't walk up to a facility and say, "Hi, I'm a member of Congress. I want to see what you're doing with the money we have allocated for you." And the difficulty they have in doing that is deeply troubling in terms of being accountable to the public and to the public's representatives.
One of the things that has cropped up in the news over the past 48 hours is this private Facebook group that members of the Customs and Border Patrol, 9,500 members of the either current or former members of the Customs and Border Patrol were members of, where they exchanged messages that were, well, overtly racist, supporting the abuse of asylum seekers who've been interned. Very, very critical and sexually graphic threats of violence against AOC, among others, but their critics and other members of Congress, particularly women of color. So this Facebook group, and for some context, there are 9,500 members of this Facebook group. The Customs and Border Patrol claims that, or on its website, says it has about 60,000 employees. Not all of them are border agents. There are about 20,000 border agents. So it's a significant proportion. Yeah. I mean, it's not an, they issued the head issued a statement yesterday, I think, saying basically a few bad apples. You know, don't judge us by the opinions of a few. Well, it's almost 16%, I think, 9,500 out of 60,000. Does that change this debate at all, or does it add any texture to it, or what do you think, Teresa?
I mean, I think that it does a bit, also because these individuals are in positions of power at the moment, and the power within these facilities or controlling flow in and out of them is in and of itself should be a reason for caution and responsibility, okay? But extracting that sort of from the discussion or from the equation, I think I'm quite shocked by the number that are, to see the language of ethnicity or nationalism, discriminatory remarks being used to this extent by members who, by individuals who are in positions of power at these sites, adds another layer of a very problematic dynamic, which, in my view, gives more credence and credibility to the use of the term concentration camp.
Hey, do we see a similar development in the concentration camps you've studied? In other words, do guards become worse as time passes? And so, I mean, they didn't all go in as SS death camp guards, right?
No, they did not.
So what happened?
Absolutely. I mean, there's within these camp structures, one of the more interesting elements that's fed into our understanding as both as historians, but also sociologists and others working outside of the field of history into how concentration camps functioned, but also how, you know, groups responsible for mass murder and extermination functioned, was looking at the psychology of the perpetrators. And this has, you know, trauma studies has impacted this, psychological studies, etc. So it's a very multi and interdisciplinary field. And key studies have shown us that the mindset of the perpetrators, it's difficult to speak of the mindset, but the actions did escalate in response to an escalating degree of atrocities being witnessed on a daily basis. But brutality was often encouraged as a form of control. So again, it's these concentration camps from their early inception, when they were, detention sites or preemptive custody centers, different terms are applicable here, but a key component there was still the use of arbitrary violence, brutality, and dehumanization, all in an attempt to really alter the social norms of the individuals within these centers, but also to destroy them for life after they got out. And this is where I see a significant problem and more impetus being given to the concentration camp.
Yeah, I've always been sort of worried with groups, like INS and Customs and Border Patrol, that, the kinds of people who are attracted to work in these facilities, that they either have explicitly or implicitly very dark motivations for doing so, that, if you get to be a guard at one of these facilities, there's a sort of embedded nationalist and racist ideology in play for most of the people working there, but at least for some of them there is, and that's troubling to me, that we sort of have these institutions of power that feed off of that impulse. The other thing that's striking to me about these facilities today is the intersection between detention and the sort of prison industrial complex, because a lot of these facilities some of them are being run directly by Customs and Border Patrol and by INS, and some of them are being run by private corporations, and some of them are being run in sort of weird hybrid things where parts of it are being administered by the government, which theoretically is accountable, although we haven't seen that yet, but also by private corporations who are seeing these as profit centers, and those aren't accountable in the same way, and that's really troubling to me. I mean, I think part of the reason why we have such profound overcrowding and such bad conditions in these facilities is in part because of bad policy, but also partially because this is the way that these corporations make money. If you can fit 80 people in a room designed for 30 people and nobody complains about it because nobody knows it's happening, because the people who are in there don't have access to the outside world to complain about it, that's a way to make money for your shareholders, corporate overlords, what have you. It's deeply troubling, in this context. It's troubling in a broader context in which, millions of Americans are now being held, having their liberty taken away, being run by private corporations. I don't think that's morally justifiable, even if it makes financial sense for the government to do it. I don't think that's. But I think this is. There's a relationship there that people need. I think hasn't been fully teased out yet.
Well, I agree with you. Although it does bear. I think you're absolutely right. We haven't explored that to the sufficient extent. And that privatization has gone on for decades. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've privatized war. So I think that's important. Although in this particular case, of course, that Facebook group, the members of the Customs and Border Patrol Union, those are
government employees.
Those are government employees. But I take your point, David. You're absolutely right. I mean, basically, one could say, well, if the government employees are saying this, God knows what they're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
At, you know, Acme Prisons or Us or whatever the corporation is, yeah. You know, what their employees are saying or doing and what kind of oversight.
Yeah. Those are people who can't get the Customs and Border Patrol right. jobs because they didn't pass the background check.
That's right. Yeah. So, you're absolutely right to voice concern about that, David. We're terrible at predictions, and we're not in the business of predicting. Well, but I mean, again, looking at Teresa, the history of this is not good. I mean, these things tend to get worse before they
absolutely
get better, and it often takes exterior pressure, sometimes like wars, to stop them.
Or it will take a massive shock, even more than what's happened with the release of these reports. So, the death toll of children is at, what, 7 now, as far
that we know
as,
of,
that,
yeah.
we, that we know of, absolutely. And this has, I think it's really mobilized and shocked the American public. But now I guess we'll have to see if that translates into, can this be dislodged in the immediate future in any rapid way? Probably not. You know, the idea of deterring asylum seekers from crossing the border, that's going to be something I don't think we're going to resolve in the next few weeks on the basis of this crisis. However, what can be done in an immediate sense is to alter the nature of these facilities, to move away from the overcrowding, the physical torture, the things that are dehumanizing children, and then, you know, and to do something in a very immediate sense about that. I think that is possible now.
Now,
will it happen?
I've had several dispiriting conversations in the past couple of weeks about this. What actually can we do as citizens, as political actors with whatever small bit of power that we have? What is it that we can actually be done now? Or what can our elected representatives who listen to us do now to ameliorate the situation, if not radically change it?
Sharing of images, stories, testimonies, public outreach, a lot of engagements, spreading the nature of what is happening at these detention facilities and how it's impacting individuals. But in conjunction with historians getting on board and journalists, as obviously they have been doing, but also active members of the public, just more information circulating about the nature of these centers and the impact this is having on human life, but also on very young human life.
I think I would agree with that completely. I also think where possible, one should put pressure on one's congresspersons and representatives and senators and government officials. And I also think if people have the means to do so, they should donate to the organizations that are doing heroic work, both bringing this stuff to our attention, this horrible behavior to our attention, but also trying to ameliorate the conditions in these facilities. And because there are groups that are involved in that, especially in Texas at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're having mixed success because sometimes they're being denied access. But even, you know, there was a woman arrested, I think, in California yesterday, a grandmother who turned up with toys. Well, God bless her, and if she got in and was able to give toys to the children in the facility, that would be great. But apropos of your comment, Teresa, about raising public awareness, that image of a grandmother being arrested bringing toys to an internment facility is a very powerful image. So I think, you know, we need to give her the money to buy the toys and help her make bail.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, the horrific thing about that, of course, is not it's not as if the government doesn't have money to buy the toys and the toothbrush and the soap. And the denial of these things is you know, not because there's an inadequate supply, but as a matter of cruelty. And so, you know, if charitable organizations, in some ways there's something very perverse about supporting charitable organizations doing things the government should do and can do, but isn't doing out of willful spite.
Well, it's not just spite, David. I think it's worse than that because, so the backlash, I mean, Kellyanne Conway attacked AOC this morning, claiming that hers were crocodile tears because she hasn't voted any money to improve the facilities. Because there's a bill in Congress which is basically to build the wall.
Yes.
So basically they're holding these individuals who've been interned, and they're putting them in these horrible conditions, including, but not only, children, and making them suffer to extort money for the wall. So it's, on one hand, there's a gratuitous cruelty to it. The other, but on another, there's a
they're hostages.
There's intention there. Yeah, they are hostages to Trump's border. So it's a
Part of me wants to storm the Bastille, except there are hundreds of Bastilles, and I'm not good at storming things.
And we're thousands and thousands of miles away.
Yeah, these practical things, frankly, get in the way. But, like, you know.
Although it should be said, internment like this is being carried out across the West right now, including in the UK, in terms of migrants.
Australia.
You know, this is not a. We're back to it not being exceptionalist.
Central Europe as well.
Exactly. So this is. I mean, this is not to exculpate or exonerate the Trump administration and its policies, but this is a bigger problem than the United States.
So we need to storm multiple Bastilles, transnational.
Yeah.
Bastille storming.
Exactly.
I do think that as historians, we're kind of on the nature of our job, what it is that we actually do. We're uniquely place to be able to look at these patterns and to extrapolate them and then to, you know, to present them in a way that doesn't necessarily say, you know, because there are problematic facilities, concentration camps on the U.S. border at the moment, it doesn't mean that the Trump administration are Nazis, but it means that these sites exist and they're problematic, they're happening across the world, they have been for a century now, and they do have certain things, you know, they have certain ways of operating, like I said, forms and functions, and we can talk about that. We're, you know, we have the history to back us up, and it is not unreasonable to raise these concerns and then to bring them to people who I think majority will be indignant to look at the image of a grandmother being arrested for bringing toys to children, or to look at 50 women in a room meant for five. You know, this is, it's not... I'm hoping to stem some of the desperation of that comes from the question, what can we actually do, particularly as historians.
I think that's a hopeful note to end on. It speaks to us as historians. So
I guess it's time for last drops, Frank. Well, you want to?
I do. I mean, it seems slightly inappropriate to change gears here, but today is the 3rd of July, and on July 3rd, 1776, John Adams wrote a wonderful letter to his wife Abigail Adams, reflecting on what Congress had done the day before. And if you bear with me for just a second, I will share some of that with you. And John Adams wrote, hang on for just a second, that the 2nd of July would always be remembered as the 2nd of July, 1776, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore. And this is this is peak John Adams in the sense that he's not wrong, but he is wrong. Because, of course... we don't remember the 2nd of July, although the 2nd of July was the day that Congress voted on independence. Mm-hmm. We remember the 4th of July, which is the day it formally adopted the Declaration stating that independence. And so it's a very John Adams letter. Of course, the 4th came the next day, so maybe on the 5th he might have written something different, but he identified the 2nd of July as the day we would remember. Mm-hmm. It's appropriate for you and me, David, because last night we went to the U.S. Consulate's Independence Day celebration.
Which is always an excellent time.
Yeah, it's always an excellent time, and it's never on the 4th of July, because the 4th of July is a federal holiday. And so the people who work at the U.S. Consulate don't work on the 4th of July. And so it was on the 2nd, appropriately, this year. I do have a slight bone to pick, and David's heard me say this before. In fact, listeners have heard me say this before. Fiona Hislop from the Scottish Government and the Scottish National Party made some welcoming remarks, or said a few remarks, and they were... I've heard her say basically the same remarks in the past. That's fine. Politicians do that. Except she made the claim that the U.S. Declaration of Independence was inspired by the Declaration of Arbroath. And that is just the Scottish Declaration of Arbroath from the Middle Ages. That is not true. There is no evidence to support that. The Declaration of Arbroath was actually not even called the Declaration of Arbroath till the 1920s. It was the papal letter before that, because a bunch of Scottish aristocrats wrote to the Pope. It is not a Declaration of Independence, but we can set that aside. There is no evidence to demonstrate a connection between the Declaration of Arbroath and the U.S. Declaration of Independence. However, this is something that nationalists here in Scotland often say, and I've heard Fiona Hislop, among others, say it repeatedly. Tom Devine, our colleague, warned her off doing this several years ago. I was in the room, and he said, "You really shouldn't do this. There's no connection." So yesterday she claimed that there was a dispute about this. There is no dispute. The only dispute is that she said, or a debate about it, she said, some people claim this. Well, they're wrong. There is no debate about this, and they should stop saying it. There are strong Scottish connections to American independence, particularly from the Scottish Enlightenment, but not from the Declaration of Arbroath. And nationalists here in Scotland and white supremacists in the United States make this claim, and they should stop.
Wow. Dear listener, I was standing next to Frank while all this was going on, and you could just see sort of the blood rising in him. I felt like I was going to have to hold him back from rushing the stage, although, you know, we're all more civilized, so we wouldn't do that. But, yes.
David, your last draw. My blood pressure's gone up again.
Okay. So, earlier this week, the American Historical Association, the AHA, announced that it is no longer sponsoring, condoning, helping to orchestrate the AHA interview. And for those people who are not familiar, this has been a long-standing practice for historians in the United States, people coming out of grad school or seeking employment, that early in the hiring process, there are interviews at the AHA, which is held in early January, usually in a very expensive city, and the people who can ill afford to make a trip during the holiday season are trekked off to interview for a job they probably won't get. It's been problematic for many, many years, and it's been dying.
Sorry, David.
That's all right. It's been dying for many, many years, because I think lots of play people are going over to Skype for financial reasons and other things, but it's good to see that the AHA interview is now dead and gone.
It was expensive and traumatic.
It was, yes.
Quixotic. Did you ever have an AHA interview, Teresa?
I did not, no.
You were lucky. Did you ever have a...
I did.
And how'd it go?
I had several of them. I got one campus visit out of one of them.
Okay.
But did not get the job.
Okay.
And I'm happy for it, because it was an undesirable location.
Okay. I had probably a dozen AHA interviews, and I don't want to say I didn't enjoy any of them, but it was all pretty traumatic, the whole thing. So I'm very grateful that that's a thing.
So we are saying farewell to the AHA interview, not lamenting its passing.
Well, in some ways, it was created to make the system more transparent and accessible, because I think it used to be, you know, back in the day that, you know, they'd call up a senior professor at Harvard and they'd say, "We have a job opening, who can you send us?" And I think the AHA interview was designed to make the profession more accessible to candidates who weren't necessarily in that sort of old boy network. But I think it's been problematic for years and years and years, if for no other reason that a lot of these interviews were done in hotel rooms, and there's, you know, horror stories about job candidates sitting on beds to being interviewed and whatnot. And so it's good that it's gone.
Indeed.
All right.
It sounds good.
Anyway, happy 4th of July, everyone.
Yes,
Teresa,
thank
you.
Yes,
you're
thank
welcome.
You so much.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. All right.
So,
cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.